Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it, the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for this 30th day of July 2019. I am Derek Hunter, I am your host. Thank you for listening, thanks for telling a friend, thanks for spreading the word and writing and reviewing and sharing on social media and all that good stuff. I appreciate the hell out of it. You make my my late nights worth it. You definitely do. Lots of stuff to get to, as always. Tons of things to talk about, a whole bunch of media lies to expose, and they're just lies. They're just full of crap to correct from the media, especially regarding Baltimore. Today's show will not be all about Baltimore, though. There's a lot of other stuff to get to. Last bit of housekeeping, if you want to enter to win one of the signed books by Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino, you got to email me, derek@dailycaller.com, spelled D-E-R-E-K, and just let me know. You want to be entered, and so it is written, so it shall be done. All right, let's get to it, because I've watched a lot of the media coverage over the last 24 hours since we last spoke, or I last spoke, and the media is just ridiculous. The one thing screaming racism does, when somebody points out problems in a Democrat-controlled area, is it changes the subject. All of the talk, even on Fox, well, most of the talk on Fox, not exclusively, but exclusively on MSNBC and CNN and the nightly newscast, was about how Donald Trump's tweets were racist. They don't really explain how they were racist, other than he's a white guy and he was attacking a black guy. Criticizing a black guy and a district represented by a black guy, and that's it. So what the lesson you're supposed to take away from all of this is from the left is white people are not allowed to be critical of black people. It's racist. You're not allowed to be critical of anybody. Ultimately, if you extrapolate that out to its ridiculous, stupid, natural conclusion, is you're not allowed to speak ill of anybody who is a different color than you. You have to have separate but equal criticism. You're not allowed to use common terms like rat infested or rodent infested. Those are terms. It's hard to find, you know, rodent without a news story, especially about rodents or rats that doesn't also include infested right after it. Because, you know, it's not really breaking news that there aren't a bunch of rats around. It's only breaking news when some place becomes, dare I say, infested by them. And now the word infested is racist thanks to CNN. A guy who lived in the suburbs of Baltimore is now the arbiter of everything moral and just and good that went on in Baltimore. If you don't get that reference, listen to the show yesterday and you'll hear the entire clip from Victor Blackwell. So, yes, the Democrats, well, they were all four separate but equal before, and they still are. Progressives never really changed their goal. They changed their tactics. So when it comes to language, you cannot be critical of women of color or men of color. I love Al Sharpton was up in Baltimore because when more than three TV cameras gather for any event, Al Sharpton is drawn there like a moth to a light. He was up in Baltimore. I'm not going to play you any audio. He was sadly with Michael Steele, a guy I used to have a lot of respect for, but I don't have any anymore for. I thought about calling him up and trying to get him to come in and do an interview, but you have to send, if you want to do an in-person interview with Michael Steele, you got to send a car for him. And unless he's going to be in the area anyway, and I don't have the budget to send a car for him. Standing there with his MSNBC colleague, Michael Steele railed against the president's racism. He's really become MSNBC. You soak a piece of steak in some marinade long enough and it will permeate. The marinade will permeate the entire steak. And if you take a formerly conservative person and soak them in MSNBC long enough, they will become MSNBC, and that's what happened to Michael Steele. Michael Steele also likes hammering the big fat checks he gets from MSNBC, and he recognizes that unless you toe the party line, you're probably not going to get those big fat checks for very long. And, you know, what's a little piece of your soul for financial security while you're still here on Earth? Anyway, Al Sharpton was going on about how Donald Trump is he doesn't like black people and people of color, he said. And that was the only thing that stuck out, because everything Al Sharpton does, it's plug and play. It's just, here's the name of the company, here's the outrage, the rest of the speech is all there. It's just a little diatribe, and they just plug in the names. And as soon as the check clears, Al will show up and read the script. Unless, of course, it's something that is genuinely a media feeding frenzy, then he'll shove his way into the front. Nobody's hammering him a check for going to Baltimore today or yesterday, but it doesn't matter. It's all the same. He is a robot. He's autocomplete. That's what Al Sharpton is. He's autocomplete on a Google search. It says such and such is racist, and the racist part just shows up. But I thought it was very weird. So the president doesn't like black people or people of color. I don't know. I'm not up to date on the latest politically correct terms because I don't care. But it strikes me as though if you're going to use this blanket term, people of color, that covers black people, right? It covers everybody who's not white. That's the way it was designed. That's why this term was created, is to signify white people as the other, to try and manipulate people's emotions. But Democrats, of course, I always say that the country has gone from a melting pot to a series of chafing dishes. But inside those chafing dishes, they have smaller chafing dishes that they want to cram everybody into. So this is the people of color one, and then there's a subset of this color and this shade and this. They're really just disgusting racists. And they want to make sure that nobody, no people of non-color, you clear people who are nothing but a skeletal structure in a circular system, a circulatory system, ever say anything negative about somebody who isn't white. You're not allowed to. You're the problem. You're the problem, whitey. Stop being so white all the time, and we could get over these problems. Yeah, except the problems that we're talking about with Baltimore are not caused by Whitey. Whitey hasn't had power in the Maryland 7th District in a long time. In the city of Baltimore, last time Whitey had power, it was Martin O'Malley. In Martin O'Malley's two terms as mayor, he had stepped up police enforcement, shall we say, a zero tolerance policy. He wanted to bring crime down, and he did, and he celebrated it, and he learned yoga so he could fellate himself to celebrate his accomplishment of bringing crime down. Now, of course, he doesn't like to talk about how he managed to bring crime down. And the way he did it, because it's unfashionable in the Democratic Party, the way that he did it was to arrest everybody for everything. Used to be, and they talked about this on The Wire. They did a bunch of episodes about this. The zero tolerance. Used to be, you know, you can't drink out in public unless you're at a festival or something where it's sanctioned, which means sanctions is code for the city's getting a taste. They're getting a piece of the action. But you can't go buy a bottle of beer and walk down the street drinking your beer. Even if you're an adult, you can't do it. Open intoxicants, it's a ticket. You get arrested, you get a ticket, whatever. But used to be if you carried it in a paper bag, and that's where the paper bag comes in. It serves two purposes. It hides that it's beer that you're drinking, and it also serves as a little bit of insulation to keep it colder longer. But if you are the type of person who can't wait to get somewhere to drink your beer, your beer doesn't run risk of going warm. Just saying. Used to be if you were walking down the street and you're drinking a beer in a bag, it was no big deal. The police kind of said, well, that could be any kind of liquid in there. Maybe he's hydrating. Could be Gatorade for all we know. Moving on. Well, Martin O'Malley wanted to go after everybody for everything. Kind of the broken windows theory that worked in New York, although he would never call it that. And so the number of arrests ramped up significantly. It got to the point that over Martin O'Malley's tenure as mayor, the average arrests in the city of Baltimore were 100,000 a year. Think about that. 100,000 arrests per year in a city whose population was just above 600,000. One in six people were arrested in Baltimore. Of course, it wasn't 100,000 different people. It was probably about 40,000 people a time and a quarter. But you get the idea. He ramped up arrests. That made the crime statistics go down. Congratulations, Martin O'Malley. That allowed you to be elected governor of the state of Maryland. That and the fact that there's overwhelming Democratic majorities in the state. The after effects of Martin O'Malley's tenure as mayor with all those arrests were a whole bunch of people who had arrest records now, who hadn't really done much of anything. Maybe they loitered. Maybe they were drinking as they were walking down the street. Not a good way to live your life, but it's certainly not hurting other people. But now you've got an arrest record, and you go for a job. And guess what they might check? They don't always check, but they might check whether or not you've ever been arrested and or convicted of a crime. And thanks to Martin O'Malley's self-congratulatory pat himself on the back, must lower crime statistics push, you now have a criminal record. And your employer or potential employer finds out about that, and guess what they're probably not going to do? They're probably not going to hire you. They're probably going to hire somebody else. So while Martin O'Malley was congratulating himself on how successful and wonderful he was at lowering the crime rate in Baltimore, in his wake were thousands of more ruined lives. Another bit of unintended consequence from liberal progressive policies. It's funny how that works out. You know how they always say, we're moving forward. Let's move forward together. Come on, we're pushing forward. The reason they say that is because they don't want you to look behind you and see the devastation in their wake. They just want to go forward. Let's go forward. Let's keep pushing. Let's keep going. Don't look back there. Don't listen to those screams of the people that I've screwed over. Just keep moving on. So there's your Martin O'Malley. That kind of helped set the stage. It certainly, that wasn't the problem in Baltimore by any stretch of the imagination, but it didn't help. It certainly didn't help, and it made things worse. Baltimore was a wreck long before that. So now we get to the present day. Donald Trump tweets about how rat-infested Baltimore is, which there had been many, many news stories about, a PBS documentary about. The Baltimore Sun has talked about this on numerous occasions, yet now they say, Donald Trump, it's rather better to have a few rats than to be one, Donald Trump. Yeah, okay, tell that to your kid who just got bit by a rat, now has to get rabies tests. I'm pretty sure that person would have a different opinion, Baltimore Sun editorial board, but they're hacks. And remember, progressives are progressives first and foremost, and individuals are disposable. They're irrelevant to the left. It is all about the greater good, comrade. So I'm watching a couple of news things today, and this is a little factoid that has been repeated throughout the news. I kind of addressed this yesterday, but I want to address it a little bit more today because you're likely going to hear it from your liberal friends. And even if you don't hear it from your liberal friends, they're hearing it. Or even your, more importantly, not your liberal friends, your sane friends. And it was reported by CBS News. It was reported on MSNBC. It's been repeated ad nauseum by talking heads who immediately follow it with a Tourette's sort of, Trump's a racist, sort of herky-jerk sort of reaction. A graphic on the CBS Evening News read, 7th Congressional District of Maryland, second highest median income among districts that are at least half black. Now, there's a lot of hoops to jump through to try and make the argument that Congressman Elijah Cummings' district isn't, as Bernie Sanders so aptly put it, like a third world country. But there's a problem with it. The 7th District of Maryland used to almost exclusively encompass Baltimore City, a little bit of the county, and every 10 years they redraw these lines. Well, after the 2010 census, when the aforementioned Martin O'Malley was in the governor's mansion, he got together his little gang of thieves, his Democratic partisans, and decided that they were going to redistrict the state not based on changing populations, you know, people moving, based exclusively on electing Democrats. Maryland used to have three Republicans in Congress, and now they only have one. So that was wildly successful. They managed to turn two seats blue without the electorate changing at all. They just changed the electorate. That was it. It's very simple, very corrupt, very typical in Democratic states. But you never hear Democrats whine about that when they talk about gerrymandering. Well, in doing so, Elijah Cummings' district was changed geographically significantly. It was extended further out into Baltimore County, and it was given parts of Howard County. Most importantly, from a statistical standpoint, it was given Columbia, Maryland. Now, Columbia, most of Maryland is very quote-unquote progressive, so Democrats are safe. But throughout there were pockets of Republicans, conservatives, that were clustered together because they, you know, want to be represented by somebody who agrees with them, who believes in what they believe, who likes the country, for example. Crazy stuff like that. Well, those lines were thrown away and those people were absorbed into these overwhelmingly liberal districts. In drawing Elijah Cummings' district down to Columbia, Maryland, which is a good 30 to 40 minute drive, depending on your time of day, from Baltimore, Elijah Cummings' district's average income increased significantly. Columbia, Maryland routinely makes the lists of the nicest places in the country to live. It literally has nothing aside from that human beings live there in common with what used to be the 7th Congressional District in the state of Maryland. It had nothing to do except that there are human beings that live there with what Elijah Cummings used to represent. Now, the people of Columbia don't particularly care. They're not overwhelmingly government dependent. They're just progressive Democrats who go and vote for the D, pay their taxes, and then feel really proud about themselves, think they're super duper progressive and awesome and tolerant and love everybody while they run back to their white communities and lock their doors and set their ADT systems to armed at night. That is the hypocrisy of the world these people live in. They don't give a damn or a thought to the people who live in Baltimore who don't have locks on their doors, not because they don't want them, but because the door jamb's been kicked in a few times, or the lock is broken, or there's a big hole in the ceiling, or there's rats living in the basement, or whatever the problem is. The next door neighbor is full of, the old house that's abandoned is full of junkies. Or people like me where I lived, where, you know, the service area of the row house where I rented the basement was full of people going in there and shooting up, and I think probably prostitutes too. They don't care about people like that. They don't give them a second thought. They vote for Democrats and they think of that as doing something. Meanwhile, those districts continue to become dilapidated. But what happens is Elijah Cummings' district's average income, since Columbia is a very hoity-toity area, those numbers go up. So you can say, wow, they've got the average income. There's the things that they say about Elijah Cummings' district were not true before 2013 when the new districts took effect. But nobody's bothered to look back into that because that's too much like work for a journalist. They say that Elijah's district has one of the highest rates of black college graduates in the country. Yeah, that's not West Baltimore. That's Baltimore County. That's Columbia, Maryland. They say that the statistics show that Elijah Cummings' district, the 7th District of Maryland, is the second highest income for a district that's majority black. In fact, the average income in the district is $58,000 per year. That's above the national average. My goodness, they are so super duper, uber progressive. And look at the success of Elijah Cummings. My God, it's a success story. With that kind of record, why isn't Elijah Cummings running for governor of Maryland? He could come in and say, I took over a bombed out area, and now the average income is $58,000 a year. Congratulations. Promote me. Because the numbers are garbage. though the numbers are true in the sense that if you add up the population and you add up their income and you divide it, you'll probably get around $58,000. They're not making up those numbers. They're not telling you where they're getting those numbers. Elijah Cummings' district that he was elected to 20 years ago is in West Baltimore. The fate of West Baltimore has gone steadily downhill. But again, if you get to choose the unit of measure, you will always be the best looking, the smartest, the coolest, the neatest, the richest, whatever it is. If you get to decide what it is. So if you get to throw in a whole bunch of people who have nothing to do with where you actually live and the people who've elected you over those 20 years, and suddenly they're all rich, well, guess what happens? Your average income goes up significantly. That's progress in the democratic world. Not a single human being's life was improved by that, but you just got your average income increased, and you can go out and campaign on that. You can go out and be held up as a pillar in the community and an example of what could happen and what should happen. Of course, no one, literally no one, in the mainstream media bothered to tell anybody that, bothered to point that out, except for me, because I happen to live there. I happen to see it. I happen to experience it firsthand until I escaped in a hot air balloon. And 2014, I guess it was. But that's the reality of it. It is, when you talk about Elijah Cummings District, you talk about Baltimore. You talk about West Baltimore. Not the screwy map Rorschach test that they drew up to screw over Republicans. It's too hard to explain. It just took me 20 minutes or 15 minutes to explain it. Nobody in cable news, nobody in network news, and nobody at a print outfit is going to take the time to explain that to anybody. Besides, most of the people who would, whose job it theoretically is to do something like that and do it much more concise rather than ad-libbing a monologue, they're on the team. They're not going to go after Elijah Cummings. They've got their marching orders. Donald Trump is racist. Elijah Cummings is sweet and nourishing and done wonders for the city of Baltimore, cares deeply about the people, and that's it. Anything to the contrary of that might be met with reassignment to something you don't want to do. Besides, it's an awful lot like work if you got to do something like that. So I just wanted to make that clear to everybody, because you're being lied to. But you're being lied to with the truth, if that makes sense. They're not explaining you. It's lies of omission. They're keeping very relevant facts away from you. And that's not by accident. In some cases, it's by ignorance. But that ignorance is willful ignorance. Speaking of willful ignorance, just so you get the idea of what I'm talking about here and how it's being perceived by and portrayed by the media and the culture at large, I have a very short clip from The View. Joy Behar says something so incredibly stupid that it causes Whoopi Goldberg to go silent and not respond to it. It really does. And this is the operating basis of just about everything that the Democrats and the Democratic media does. They're talking about racism. They're talking about President Trump accusing, you know, President Trump was called a racist. So no, Elijah Cummings is the racist. The ladies at The View, Whoopi's trying to make some kind of point. She gets sidetracked by Joy's stupidity, because Joy's stupidity is epic. Listen to it.
You know, listen, we are a nation of lots of different kinds of folks, and calling folks racist when you have no idea what it actually means is ridiculous.
Oh, but, you mean because he called Elijah Cummings a racist?
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
Didn't I just say that?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to clarify. I'm just trying to make it clear to the audience who you're talking about. Because Elijah
Cummings is
the black man. He's calling the black man the racist. I mean, I don't think people understand that particularly. It's outrageous and stupid.
Yes.
To call a black person a racist. That's
okay.
All. Just clearing up.
Yeah. Whoopi's just like, okay, we're, and then they went to commercial break because it was so profoundly stupid. It's outrageous to call a black man a racist. It's outrageous. How dare you? And you think, what in the hell? Well, this is the operating mandate of the left. It is impossible for a person of color, a black person or a person of color. I don't know. I'm using their terminology. I'm trying to be super sensitive to their stupidity. It is impossible for people of color to be racist. Only whitey can be racist. That is what is being drilled into the heads of the youth across this country. It is a lie. It is garbage. But it is something that was put forth originally in a 1970 book that Communities of Resistance, writing on Black Struggles for Socialism from 1990. But Patricia Bidol, sounds like Midol, but with a B. She first put forward the idea that race plus institutional power is the only way to be a racist. Therefore, absolving everybody who is off-white of any racial animus. She just swept right over like a dustbuster, like a Swiffer, right over someone like, Louis Farrakhan, who, you know, is a noted racist, but, well, I guess he's not a racist. It is, there are two elements that need racism to exist. You got to have racial prejudice, okay, and social power to enforce that prejudice. That is the idea that was put forth by Patricia Bidol and adopted ever since by the left to absolve everybody else. Now, this freed up Democrats to go running around spewing racist crap, telling minorities across the country, whitey's out to get you. Oh, they're horrible. They're the ones stealing all the wealth. They're doing all this. They're screwing you over. Your life sucks because somebody is white someplace else. Not the progressive policies that have destroyed your neighborhood, your community, your family. No. Not the schools that are just, nope, not the, it's that white person somewhere west of here. Don't worry about it. Don't think about it. Just know that white people are your enemy. And by the way, you can hate them all you want. Go ahead, hate them. You're not, yes, we tell you that racism, being a racist is a bad thing, but turns out you can't be racist no matter how much you hate somebody for having a different skin color than you. So go forth and hate, and it's all good. And don't worry, we'll keep evil whitey at bay and make sure that your life doesn't ever improve. That's essentially what happens. But they filled people's heads with this. And now they're, the first time I ever heard this stupidity was in the mid-90s, I guess it was, on the very, this is really kind of nerdy, but the very first season of The Real World, whenever the hell that was on MTV, there was a guy named Kevin and a girl named Julie. Kevin was black and Julie was white and from the South. They had some stupid argument, and Kevin was a big racist, in my opinion. I thought he was a horrible, horrible racist. He did not like white people at all. And he was always telling how everybody's a racist, everybody's a racist, everybody's out to get him because they're racist, blah, 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 blah. He sounds like he should be an MSNBC host. And Julie called him a racist in the argument, and he put forth this idea that race plus power equals racism. I can't be racist because I don't have the power to do anything about it. And he's telling this girl who's like 18 years old, never been to New York City before, never done anything to anybody, she's just a dancer that you never heard of, that somehow she's got the power and she's oppressing him, even though he was much older than her, never met her before. I remember sitting there thinking, that's incredibly stupid. What kind of moron would believe something like that? Well, you smash cut to 20 years later, and suddenly there's an entire political party that believes that crap. That's the world we're in. This is the world that is created. It's not the splash of the stupidity dropped by a liberal into a pond. It's the ripples that reverberate forever. And eventually you hear something and you think, well, that's just stupid. Nobody's going to believe that crap. Well, you let it sit out there long enough. You let it go. You let it roll. And it suddenly becomes part of accepted, and worse, acceptable opinion in society. So you smash cut to MSNBC. We're almost done with this stuff, I promise. We smash cut to MSNBC, and they had the mayor of Baltimore on, Bernard C. Jack Young. Jack is always in quotation marks because his name is Bernard C. Young. I don't know what the C stands for, but it ain't Jack. I don't know where the Jack comes from. He goes by Jack, so people call him Jack. He was interviewed by the dumbest person on cable news, Stephanie Ruhle. I know that Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo get all the credit for the stupidity because they're on in prime time. But Stephanie's quietly amassed a really stupid portfolio in the daytime. It's like setting the minor league home run record like Crash Davis did in Bull Durham, but you know, nobody cares about it, but it is a record and still stands. Stephanie Ruhle is the dumbest person in cable news. She's just on during the daytime, so it's kind of like the minor leagues. She's interviewing Jack Young, and Jack Young says that what he wants from the president is money, plain and simple. He wants your money. Keep in mind, what you're about to hear is the guy who didn't want to be mayor. He didn't run for mayor. He's one of the few people who didn't run for mayor. But because the old mayor, the one that was elected, resigned in disgrace under scandal and is currently under several criminal probes, he's now finding himself mayor. He was just city council president. The city that he is mayor of already gets half of its annual budget, more than $1.5 billion, somewhere in that neighborhood, from the state government, because the city's tax base is so dilapidated, so decimated, so just destroyed, and other D words to complete the alliteration, that it can't support itself. So it gets half of its operating budget from the rest of the state. So Jack Young's answer of what he wants, what the city needs, how there can be more help, is, of course, naturally, give us more money.
Mayor Young, President Trump clearly has sent a message to the city of Baltimore. What's your message to him?
My message to the president is stop tweeting federal help and federal resources to the city of Baltimore. Not just to the city of Baltimore, to urban cities around the country that are having problems with aging infrastructure, with crime and grime, and a reduction in resources from the federal government.
Give us more money. Just give us more money. That's it. That's the real problem in Baltimore. Not the billions wasted, not the billions lost, not the hundreds of millions unaccounted for. There are literally tens of millions, over 60 million unaccounted for, lost in the school system alone. They really have, honestly, no idea where that money went. There's been no independent auditing. There's been no independent account. They just, it's gone. We don't know. But we need more money because it's for the children. Really? Because you're churning out kids who can't get basics in math. You got a 50% graduation rate. And the problem is you need more money? What? We're in the top five in Baltimore of spending per pupil. But that's not enough. That's not enough. Just more money keeps setting it on fire. Their annual budget is between $3 and $4 billion. Like I said, half of which comes from the state. So no matter where you live in Maryland, you're paying for the city of Baltimore with your taxes. And that's not enough. There's no accountability. Barely anybody is ever voted out of office in Baltimore. They want more money. See, the thing is, he's saying, well, the president should call me. He went on to say that when somebody becomes mayor, they usually get a call or a letter from the president of the United States saying, we want to work together. We want to do this. I've never heard of this tradition. Maybe it's true. Who the hell knows? But Donald Trump is an atypical politician. He probably doesn't know about this. His staff doesn't know about this. It's irrelevant. It's a nice little neat little tradition. And it's probably a form letter, if it ever did happen, signed by Auto Pen. But more importantly, if you're the mayor of a city somewhere, you can call the White House. See, because you're one city. That's your responsibility. As president of the United States, you're president of the entire country, which contains a lot of cities. And you're also dealing with foreign leaders, so you're really dealing with the entire world. So you don't have a whole lot of time to make 5,000 election night phone calls, letting every mayor and city council across the country know that, hey, if you ever need a Brinks truck full of money, we'll run the printers overnight and send it up to you. If you have very specific needs and very specific problems that require addressing, and you think that you can't do it on your own, but you can make a good case as to why it could be done and how it is somehow a federal responsibility, you can pick up the phone and call the White House. You can call a press conference. The mayor of Baltimore, for years, every time there's a budget coming through the state of Maryland, knows exactly how to manipulate the media and get their attention to whine and complain that they need more money from the state. So the concept isn't foreign to these mayors. So Jack Young is just sitting there going, the president didn't call me, but if he wants to help, send me more money. Moving on, because we need infrastructure. Oh, is that really the problem? So some potholes, which there are a lot of potholes in Baltimore. Fixing the potholes will fix the heroin problem? Or, you know, I don't know, fixing up the schools, the structures of the buildings that are dilapidated, will that help the out-of-wedlock birth rate? I don't think so. How about you show some initiative and show some leadership and say, hey, federal government, look at what I'm doing. Look at what we're doing already. We could do even more and better, because what we're doing works. Maybe prove what you want to do works, rather than just ask for more money to keep paying for what doesn't work. And say, we could really appreciate some help here, federal government. And if you really want to make a strong case to the federal government, you partner up with the governor of the state. And you both go together. You come up with some ideas together, and you say, put together a package, a proposal, and say, hey, Elijah Cummings, you represent most of the city. How about you get involved and you come in on this thing and come and try and pitch the president of the United States on this? That might actually work. But Elijah Cummings is too busy investigating what's going on to the poor, sweet, nourishing, illegal aliens down at the southern border. Jack Young, the mayor of Baltimore, is kind of a deer in headlights, doesn't know what the hell he's doing. And Larry Hogan, the governor, he's got his own problems to deal with when it comes to dealing with the president. He doesn't like the president very much. But there's really no concerted effort. What you heard Jack Young, the mayor of Baltimore, saying there essentially is, I need somebody to come in and do this job, or at least pay for this job. I can't be bothered. I don't know what's going on. Who am I? Why am I here? Remember, he never wanted to be mayor, and now he is. And the accidental politicians never do a good job. They just never do. You got to want to lead. You have to have a vision for leadership. You can't just want to have, you know, a job where you just have to vote on stuff and go. You don't want to be the leader. You want to be, he wants to be the second in command. He was quite content to be the city council president and just practice his way to retirement. And now he's got the reins. He probably won't run for re-election. And the city desperately needs somebody right now who wants to be mayor. But they also need somebody who wants to be mayor who isn't a progressive leftist who will do more of the same. So the hope for Baltimore ever improving, at least in our lifetime, is slim to none. And Slim just left town. Because that's what Slim does. You ever hear of Slim coming to town? Never happens. All right, that's enough about Baltimore. I had some more audio from MSNBC. They had a ridiculous panel. Are the president's racist tweets part of a strategy? Well, no, but and they're not racist, but they had their pseudo-conservative Noel Rothman on there opining about how they're just racist, and he's so racist. It's amazing what people will do to get a contract on television. But, yeah, they got the Democrats. The president has the Democrats now embracing the Gang of Four and their embrace of socialism. And now they are all rallying around Al Sharpton because the president was critical of Al Sharpton yesterday on Twitter. And people like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren tweeted about how Al Sharpton is a civil rights icon and hero to this country. And I'm thinking, you people are old enough to remember Crown Heights, Freddie's Fashion Mart, Al Sharpton, Tawana Brawley. Al Sharpton has a body count behind him. He has defamation lawsuits that he lost. He owes people hundreds of thousands of dollars. He's never paid. He owes hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes. And Al Sharpton is an icon. And how dare Donald Trump try to denigrate him? In a way, politically, whether the president meant for this to happen or not, it could work out great for him, as long as people don't start to buy the crap that they hear in media. But the audio of these people on MSNBC whining isn't really worth it, because there is other news to get to. The big number two debate is tonight. And I mean number two in every way you can possibly imagine me meaning number two. It's in my hometown of Detroit. Again, Detroit is actually a city that's doing much better than it was before in the downtown area. It really is. I was just there at the beginning of the month, and I went to school down there, and it's unrecognizable from Wayne State University to the water. People are there. There used to be this, we stopped by, my wife works in radio. She's an executive producer of a big morning show out here on a conservative talk station. And WJR is one of the stations that's owned by her company, the company that she works for. WJR is a massive station. When I was living in Baltimore, I had a rental car. Every once in a while, I'd rent a car, and with a nice radio and a new rental car, at night, we could pick up WJR in Baltimore, downtown Baltimore. I kid you not. It's that massive of a signal. And it was, as somebody who grew up listening to talk radio almost exclusively, because the music I liked was not on radio, except on Canadian radio, on Brave New Wave, starting at midnight. That's another story. So I would listen to talk radio. I just loved noise. Talking. I loved learning things. I loved news. So I would listen to WJR all the time. And I thought, well, now I'm, married to a chick who can maybe get me in the building, because the Fisher Building in downtown Detroit is a beautiful building. Art Deco, giant, gorgeous from the outside, even more gorgeous on the inside, the kind of buildings they don't make anymore. So she contacts her boss, who's a big muckety-muck in the company, and he sets up with one of the producers there, or the muckety-mucks at WJR, a tour of it. And I thought, this is awesome. I get to see where WJR happens. And it was really cool to see it. They have really nice studios. Unfortunately, they moved down like 20 floors in the building. So it's not as high as it used to be. You can't really see all the cool cityscapes that you could. It's on like the 8th floor instead of the 26th floor or whatever. But while we're there, I'm talking to their news guy who'd worked everywhere in Detroit radio. And my wife's talking to the woman who's given us the tour about all the technical stuff that I don't understand and I don't need to understand. And I'm having this conversation with the news guy. And he's telling me about how he's worked everywhere and where these stations were and how the city's really coming back. And I said, yeah, I can see it. We're going to spend the day downtown with the, I'm carrying the kid around and everything. And I said, I remember going to this Blind Pig, this after hours club in a place called the Cass Corridor. The Cass Corridor ran parallel to Woodward Avenue, which is the main drag through Detroit. And the Cass Corridor was, if you wanted to get crack, you wanted to get a hooker, you wanted to get shot, you go to the Cass Corridor. Well, I was a dumb kid who liked adventure, and we'd go down to the clubs downtown. I was always in Detroit. I never hung out in the suburbs, hated the suburbs. And there was, if you if you were cool enough at the clubs, and this is me patting myself on the back, if you were cool enough in the clubs, somebody would come up to you. You didn't know who it was. You never saw the person before. You didn't see him again. And you couldn't ask for it. Somebody would come up to you and give you a business card that said The Red Door on it. I don't remember if it had the address on it. I don't think it did. But that was your pass. That meant you could get in to The Red Door. And you were just selected because of whatever reason the person walking around passing them out thought you were cool enough and The Red Door was open that night. So once you got this thing, you kept it for as long as you were around. And you'd go there. It would open at 2. Most of the bars would close at 2, although the Gothic Club I used to go to would stay open till 5. They'd only serve until 2. But you'd go there, and you for $5, you get in. It's this metal door that looked like it had been beaten with a sledgehammer a few times. And it's in the back of a building in a sort of what used to be a couple of stores and not a strip mall. It was like a city version of a strip mall, kind of like an old grocery store or something that was cut up into several stores. And you go in there, and the lights are kind of working. They're mostly black lights or red lights. And there's a bar. They'd serve till all. I never shut down The Red Door. I shut down a lot of bars. I never shut down The Red Door. And for $5, you get in. And for $5, you could buy a giant balloon of nitrous oxide. Kids, don't do what I have done. But those were some fun times. There'd be music, and it was really loud. The place never got raided that I ever heard of because the cops didn't like to go into the cast corridor. Well, I said, I'm talking about the cast corridor, and this news guy at WJR says, well, they don't call it that anymore. So what do you mean they don't call it that anymore? Like, well, that's a negative connotation. It's got bad memories to it. So they stopped calling it. I said, what are they calling it? I said, well, it's just part of the downtown corridor. It's gone. The cast corridor down Cass Avenue is no longer called the cast corridor. And we drove it because I always drive my old haunts whenever I go back to Detroit because I like to see what's going on. It's actually nice. So the heart of downtown Detroit is doing pretty well. Thanks to Quicken Loans, the guy, the billionaire who runs Quicken Loans, his world headquarters is there. He's been buying up commercial property and businesses and buildings and everything in Detroit and revitalizing them. And God bless him. It's doing great. The neighborhoods are still crappy. You can still play many football games on most of the city blocks in the neighborhood because they still have an abandoned home problem in Detroit, but they have torn most of them down. They just haven't built anything because nobody wants to build on it. And they're talking about turning them into farms, for God's sakes. That's how much space there is in Detroit. There used to be like 5 million people in the city of Detroit. Now they're less than a million. So you got that kind of geographic area when you begin to see a problem. Well, the Democrats are there. And I strayed. Sorry. The Democrats are there and debating tonight and debating tomorrow night. The first night is the white night. It's the people of non-color night. There, aside from Elizabeth Warren, there is nary a person of color on the stage. And as they're getting ready, they were doing a lot of stories about Joe Biden's debate prep. What's going to happen? Well, and who's going to attack who? But it turns out, and who knows if this will hold up, but the stories are, as of this moment, the first night when it's Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and Marianne Williamson and a whole bunch of other nut jobs who don't stand a chance in hell getting the nomination, they've already basically said they will not be going after each other. Whether that stands up, who knows? But they're on the same page. They're essentially the same person. They just use different bathrooms. So don't expect too many fireworks. On the second night, though, Joe Biden is now promising that he's not going to be so passive. Somebody's going to wake him up. He's going to take his Geritol and get regular. I don't even know what Geritol does, but he's going to get regular and be feisty out there. He's going to show the energy that he can be president of the United States, and he's not going to take any guff off them kids. So that one could be fun because Kamala Harris is the one that everybody's talking about going in. Even though if you look at the polling data, Kamala Harris, remember she got that big bump. Oh, the Kamala Harris bump. It's so important. The way that she attacked Joe Biden on busing. I was one of those girls, Mr. Biden. Remember that? The crowd went wild. Every liberal swooned over how she handled herself. And holy cow, she was just wonderful in that debate. And she blasted Joe Biden. Well, it turns out that her position on busing is exactly the same as Joe Biden's position on busing. Don't get the federal government doing it. If local governments want to do it, fine. But not the federal mandate. So it was a complete fraud and manufactured moment, not to mention the fact that the Twitter account for her tweeted out a picture of her as a child while she was in the midst of the attack. So you know that it was completely and totally planned. Well, all of her bump from the first round of debates from that is gone. It's gone. I don't know why she's getting so much attention. A Quinnipiac poll, and this is... The number, first number I'm going to tell you is where they are now. And the second number is where they were a month ago after the first debate. Joe Biden is, of course, still in the lead. He's at 34%. That is plus 12 from a month ago. Elizabeth Warren is at 15% in second place. That's only plus 1 from last month. That's a rounding error. Then there's Kamala Harris sitting at 12%. She's lost 8 percentage points since her debate bump. So all the hype, all the buildup, all the praise, all the fawning, all the, oh my goodness, can you believe what's going on? It's gone. 8 percentage points down from the bump. Bernie Sanders is at 11%. He's down 2 more percent. Bernie's just not having a good time. Bernie's problem is everybody's Bernie. So if you can get all the whack job policy ideas without having to vote for a white guy to get them, an old white guy on top of that, an old rich white guy on top of all that, why vote for Bernie? So Bernie's biggest problem was that Bernie was far too successful in 2016. Then you got Mayor Pete at 6%, which is up 2 for him. Then there's poor, sweet, 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 nourishing Beto. Beto. Tens of millions of dollars raised and wasted, coming in at a solid 2%. But on the plus side for Beto, that's actually double what he was a month ago after the first debate. And here's how you can play statistics and make up, you know, use accurate, give real information, like I was talking about Elijah Cummings' income district. Last month after the first debate, Beto was down to 1%. Now in the Quinnipiac poll, he's at 2%. So Beto could... realistically and honestly, go out and say since the last debate, he did so well. His support has doubled. It has literally doubled since the last debate, and that would be accurate. He would never mention that it went from 1% to 2%, but that's beside the point. And then also tied with Beto is Andrew Yang at 2%, who was at 1%. He could make the same argument, but Andrew Yang seems too smart to make that argument. Beto seems too dumb to make that argument. I'm not sure he'd understand the math. So watch these debates if you can. If you can't, I'll cover them on here and have all the audio for you. But it is, it's interesting. All the hype, all the media buildup, and all the fawning and fainting over Kamala Harris's debate performance has amounted to exactly nothing, has amounted to her going back to where she was and Bernie and Joe Biden going back to where he was, up 12 points since after the last debate. And what has Joe Biden done since the last debate? Nothing, except he hasn't fallen and hasn't had a complete and total brain freeze yet, but you can't really freeze a vacuum. So Democrats seem to be kind of settling in, at least for now, the way things used to be and behind the idea that Joe Biden is the guy because Joe Biden is known. That's going to make night 2 of the debate very interesting. It'll make night 1 of the debate interesting, too, because the other 2 front runners, they've got to draw some blood from Joe Biden, and they'll have the benefit of being able to draw some blood from Joe Biden without Joe Biden actually being there. But they also run risk, depending on how they do it, and looking really petty in doing it. People tend not to like it in debate settings. And I always had this rule, and it comes from my wife who said this, is when you're doing talk radio, you don't really let... If you have a guest, and I don't have guests, I didn't have guests very often there either. But if you had a guest, and you ask, you know, you do your interview, you ask them the tough questions and whatever. Then you don't let the callers, after the guest is gone, call up and badmouth them, bash the guest that you just had, because they're not there to defend themselves. It's kind of bad form. So it'll be interesting to see how Warren and Sanders manage to be critical of Biden and point out the differences between them and Biden without making it sound desperate and kind of unseemly attacking a guy who isn't there, especially a senior citizen like Joe. My God, where's the show gone? I just looked at the timestamp. Like, holy crap, I can really ramble on for a very, very long time. I hope I'm making it entertaining, at least. I appreciate it if you made it this far. I'm checking my email. Somebody wants to know, Matthew wants to know if I took pictures of the termites flying through the wood paneling in my old apartment. No, I didn't. I did not have a cell phone at the time. I was one of the last people to get a cell phone. When cell phones first were coming around and becoming popular in the early 2000s, they did a credit check on you. And I went to Verizon and I'm like, well, you know what, I'll try a... And they were too expensive. They were like 400 anytime minutes, and then after 9, you can call anybody you want, and all those kind of deals. They were very expensive. And they did a credit check on you because they gave you the phone, I think. And my credit was so bad at the time that Verizon wanted like $1,000 deposit to open an account with me and give me a phone, like a flip phone thing. I didn't have $1,000. So I didn't have a cell phone. There was no camera phone that I had. It would have had to take a real picture. And when there's like thousands of bugs flying through your wall, the last thing you think of is, I got to document this thing. This is going to be awesome for the future. You just want it to stop because you're like, how am I ever going to sleep in this place with all these bugs? But they eventually stopped and I went to bed about 3 o'clock in the morning. And didn't go to work the next day because I had to wait for the exterminator. There are a couple of other things. The DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, is in upheaval. It is, the wheels have come off. It's kind of a funny story because it is Democrats getting a big old dose of their own medicine. The executive director is a woman named Allison Jaslow. She was hired by Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, who was elected the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. It's always a member of Congress, same with Republicans. And then they populate the staff and they raise money for all congressional candidates and they disperse the money. It's a powerful position of influence. Well, it turns out that Sherry Bustos, Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, I love this. Congresswoman Bustos hired a white woman to run the DSCC. Allison Jaslow is apparently white. And Allison Jaslow apparently hired too many white people to be in leadership of the DCCC. They need to come up with better names for these things. So the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus were very, very upset by this. Too many white people running this. They're all liberal progressives, and they're all on the same team. It shouldn't matter. They don't actually do, and they raise money. They hammer checks. They send out fundraising emails. But they can make some good money at it as well and also make a lot of contacts so that they can go into fundraising on their own and become filthy rich. Well, Bustos hires Jaslow. Jaslow apparently hires a bunch of white people. I don't think it's exclusively white people. They don't actually have the breakdown of it. But the Politico story is two Hispanic lawmakers called for Jaslow's resignation in a statement to Politico. They released a statement, quote, "The DCCC is now in complete chaos. The single most immediate action that Sherry Bustos can take to restore confidence in the organization is to promote diversity is to appoint a qualified person of color, of which there are many, as executive director at once. We find the silence of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus on this issue to be deafening." Well, they weren't deaf for very long. The Congressional Black Caucus got on board, and a few hours later, Jaslow was resigning. Why? Because she's too white. Honestly, that's why she resigned. And then within a matter of a couple of hours after that, most of the leadership of the DCCC resigned because they were apparently too white. Anybody who was off-white was safe, apparently, but if you're white, you were fired. This is the Democratic Party. It's not, hey, are you good at your job? Are you competent at doing your job? Are you going to help us raise a lot of money to try and win and maintain seats in the U.S. Congress? No, it is, what flavor of human being are you? What's your ethnic background? Can we get a nice swab of your cheek? And we're going to send that off to 23andMe and Ancestry.com just to double check to find out whether or not you are diverse enough for us to care. It's not, incompetence has nothing to do with it. I mean, hell, look at half the elected Democrats out there. Look at Elijah Cummings. Competence has nothing to do with it. Everything they do is about skin color. That's the world we live in. That's the world they've created. And it always comes back and bites them in the ass. And it's a very, very glorious thing. So as the debate ramps up for tonight, just know that the Democrats are in a bit of a kerfuffle of their own, kind of accusing, they didn't go as far as to say you're racist, but it's celebrate diversity. Fire people so that you can hire minorities. Just seems condescending. How'd you get your job? Well, I applied for it and I was most qualified. How'd you get yours? A bunch of politicians demanded that people who had the jobs quit so that they could hire people of a different color. Oh, really? You couldn't handle this privately? Nope. They're getting woke points. Finally, today, remember the lady soccer? Remember when that was a thing? It seems like forever ago. The U.S. national team, they'd won the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, and they were whining, and now their fight for equal pay continues. The struggle. Oh, the heroic struggle that they're... Well, turns out that they're overpaid. They're way overpaid. I told you how they were overpaid before, but this really hammers it home. TMZ is reporting, quote, from 2009 through 2019, a time frame that includes two Women's World Cup championships, the women's national team has earned gross revenue of $101.3 million over 238 games for an average of $425,446 per game. Not bad, not too shabby. The men's national team has earned a gross revenue of $185.7 million, which is shocking. The men's team sucks. I'll give the women that they're better than the men relative to other women. I still think the men would kick the crap out of them. They lost to a bunch of 15-year-old boys. Over 191 games for an average of $972,147 per game. More specifically, TMZ continues, the women's national team games have generated a net profit, ticket revenues minus event expenses, in only 2 years, 2016 and 2017. That means that every other year in that decade from 09 to 19 to this year, they've operated at a loss. So for two of those years, they had a little bit of a profit. Across the entire 11-year period, TMZ reports, the women's national team games generated a net loss of $27.5 million. They're operating at a net loss of $27.5 million over 11 years. And they're whining that they're not paid enough. They owe. They owe, if you're being fair, if people are being paid a percentage of what they earn after expenses, they shouldn't have been paid at all. They should have, you know, I don't know, been paying for the privilege. But that would be cruel and wrong and sexist and horrible, and nobody's calling for that. But I would point out that if they want to be paid more, it's not even maybe they should earn more. It's maybe they should earn more than they cost. That'd be a good place to start for Megan Rapinoe and all of her fellow travelers out there on the women's national team. They're now touring the country. You can pay a bunch of money to go watch them play for fun, which just sounds even more... I didn't know you could make soccer more boring. Come watch us dick around for fun. No, I'm going to pass. I got the number two debate to watch tonight. Boy, howdy, is it number two. Thank you for listening. I'll be watching the number two debate, and we'll talk about all the number twos dropped up on stage in Detroit. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Keep doing all that good stuff. Be back here tomorrow for another exciting episode.
It's outrageous and stupid.
Yes.
To call a black person a racist. That's okay. All.